everyone, and welcome along. I'm Alice Worsley, looking after you for the next 25 minutes here on Planet FM with a wonderful story to tell from author Jenny Patrick, a New Zealand author who has just written a magnificent book called The Denniston Rose, and it's been on the best-selling lists for quite a few weeks now. It's the story about a bleak coal mining settlement of Denniston in the South Island, isolated high on the plateau above New Zealand's west coast, and it's the kind of place that makes or breaks those who live there. And at the time of this novel, which is in the 1880s in New Zealand's history, the only way to reach this makeshift collection of huts, tents and saloons is to climb aboard an empty coal wagon to be hauled 2,000 feet up the terrifyingly steep incline. This is a wonderful story. It's based on fact, part of it, but fiction a lot of it, but the imagination of the author is just wonderful. My guest today, Jenny Patrick. Jenny, you've been known for many years as a wonderful jeweller. You have a great talent in that area. It's only recently now, with the Denniston Rose, we're hearing of you as a great novelist.
Wow.
Well, soon to be a great novelist, I'm sure. Yeah. But tell us a little bit about the jewellery side of you, first of all.
Well, I've been making jewellery perhaps full-time for, well, since I was in my 30s. And I've been known probably for making particularly power and silver jewellery. But I started off way back in the 70s in a craft market, in the days when craft markets were, you know, all the rage. And gradually I built up a sort of clientele of people who came back to me. So I would make their children's christening spoons, and then their 21st birthday presents, and then the adults' 25th wedding anniversary presents, and so on. And so I stopped supplying for the market, and I just did private order from home and worked exhibitions, and some of my jewellery was picked up in national touring exhibitions and that sort of thing.
Fantastic. Yeah. Have you ever had to make a piece of jewellery for anyone very well known that you can talk about?
Well, once I had to make some a set of worry beads for Robert Muldoon to take. He was visiting the Eastern Emirates, I mean, places that are right in the news right now, and it was he was told that the sort of gift he had to make was individual worry beads, and so I had to make them. I made them with greenstone beads, and then the little tassel at the bottom has to be, everyone has to be different. And a man from the Egyptian embassy came up to give me a little lesson on worry beads and how the tassel had to be this long and this wide, but individual. And then I made them out of silver, and the tassel and carved it with a separate design that had some Maori and New Zealand. So that was one. And I provided the wedding gift, I think, for the Princess of Tonga at one side. This was from New Zealand. I did a few things that were ordered by the government to gifts for overseas.
Nice to be on the calling list, isn't it, for the odd thing
lovely.
Like that?
Yes, lovely and nice to think that. Mind you, I think also a gift of mine was given to Ceaușescu, the middle, I forget where he was, but he was a terrible dictator.
Right. Over in Eastern Europe.
In Eastern Europe, yes. Mm.
That's right. Well, yeah, so your pieces sort of go to some famous and infamous people.
Yes, that's right. I had no control, really.
That's right. So tell me about the desire to write, because even though this is your first novel, the writing's been around for quite a while, hasn't it?
Yes, it might even have been before my desire to write was before even jewellery, probably. But not in the fiction area, apart from a few stories for school journals. But I've always written for radio, more commentary, kind of like The Looking at Ourselves and Sunday Supplement, those kind of things, just commentary kind of things. And then I have written, with my husband Lawton, I've written many, many songs. He's the musician.
And you're the lyric lady.
I'm the lyric lady. So we have written many songs for children and shows, musical shows for children that are performed around New Zealand.
Okay, so that's where it all began. But then you went and took a course in Wellington with Bill Manhire, who does this very, I believe it's very famous now, creative writing course.
Yes.
Did you have to submit pieces in order to be accepted?
Yes, I did. And I felt myself to be hugely lucky to get in. I'd been chair of the Arts Council for 5 years, 7 years. And so that had been a bit of a break from jewellery, or I couldn't do jewellery full time. And I thought, well, when I stop being at the Arts Council, I'm going to try something new. And I applied to get into this course. And I think most of the people who apply have already been writing fiction a lot and send in the best of their oeuvre. But I didn't have anything, so I had to write a poem and a piece, you know, and I wrote all these in. And I was absolutely astounded and delighted to get chosen. There were only 12 of us out of hundreds that apply. And we were a wonderful mixed batch of people. I was probably the oldest, and there were all the way down to youngest. And it was a fantastic course.
A year-long course?
A year-long course, yes. Well, it was half a year of lectures, and the other half year we had to produce a body of work. So it sort of lasted a year, yes.
So at the end of it, what do you feel that going on a course like that did for you as a writer?
Well, particularly it gave me confidence, and it gave me, I mean, every week we had to write something, and Bill gave us the most outrageous and difficult and strange exercises to do, sometimes a poem, sometimes a piece of prose, and we would have to go back and read it to the rest of the class, and the rest of the class would add their acid or pleased comments and so on. So you got an audience every week, and you also were pushed to use your imagination, and Bill would give us little pieces of writing from other people's work. But it was particularly having that audience and being given the confidence that you could speak to an audience in a way.
So was it during this time that the ideas for your book, The Dennis and Rose, started to bubble up?
Yeah. Not really, no. I mean, the first thing that I did when I came, I mean, the piece that I did for my major piece was a series of letters between, like a love story between two old people, and a little bit based on a relationship my mother had after my dad died. And that was picked up by radio, and it was quite successful on radio, I think. And so that was my first big work, and then I started writing another novel that was quite different from The Denniston Rose. It was sort of based on family things again. And I was having a bit of a struggle with it. And then I was at a writers and readers conference, the first one that I had something to do with, and there was a wonderful panel with Annie Prue and Carol Shields and Kate Grenville and our own Kerry Hume, and they were talking about imagination and so on. And somebody was extolling writing about what you know, and Annie Prue growled away in her grumpy kind of way. "Forget about that old adage," she said. "Why don't you write something you don't know anything about? It really frees the imagination." So I thought, right, I went and kicked that book under the table, under the bed, and I thought, I'd been to Denniston, visited it.
So it's on the west coast of the South Island, right?
It is on the west coast, yes. And I'd been fascinated reading the sort of dock billboards up there that tell you about the old days, and I read about these women who had come up back in the 1880s. The only way up in those days was to get in an empty coal wagon. And
so it was a coal mining area.
It was a coal mining town.
Right, okay, yep.
At the top of a plateau, on a high, bleak plateau, 2,000 feet up from sea level, and the bleakest place you could imagine. But it was very rich in coal. And so miners came up there and people to mine.
So the only way you could get up was to go up in these coal
wagons? These coal wagons. The only way you could do it. There was no track, no road. Of course there is now, but there was nothing then. And some women had such a horrendous journey, being hauled up almost vertical up these 2,000 feet in the coal wagon. They never came down again for 20 years until they built the road. And I thought, when I read about this, I thought there must be a story in this. And so I started to write. I started to write particularly about the women. You know, that was where I put my story to start with. The child wasn't there.
Right. So, but you obviously, Denniston was the place. You knew a little bit about it, but then you would have, I would imagine, done a lot of research.
A lot of research.
Where did you go to get your information?
Well, I went back to Denniston and several times, and I made contact with an old coal miner there, Jeff Jeff Kitchen. Unfortunately, he died. But he was wonderful. He was a sort of amateur historian himself, and he had lots of old photographs and mine reports and so on. And he took the time to walk me all over what is now a ghost town and describe how it had been when he grew up there and when his parents and grandparents grew up. So he was great. And I also went to the National Library, to their newspaper room, and read old newspapers back in those Westport Newses, you know, and you got a lot of local colour for that.
Including the local ads.
Yes, all the ads. I mean, how much material cost and what kind of clothes they wore and what a salary was and what it cost to rent. I mean, the ads are fantastic, and all the old remedies that they had.
The snake oil,
the whole long 9 yards of it. So the ads were particularly good to read. And there was a book that I came across also that was written by, probably in the 1950s, I think, by a schoolmaster up there that was talked about the social history of the place. And that called a little booklet called The Denniston Affair, and that was very useful too.
So how then did your characters come about?
Well, that out of my head, really, although the research built up a picture of the community there, that there were different kinds of people up there. There were the miners, the recruited English miners, who were mainly Chapel Methodists and often Unionists, and they were one breed. And I thought, well, one of my families will be like this, a Unionist and so on, because I talk in the book about the first miner strike, which actually was on Denniston. And then there were the ex-gold miners and the riffraff who were up there because they had no other job, and I made some of my characters like that. And then there were the school teachers, the shopkeepers and so on, more the entrepreneurial ones, and so I made one of my families like that.
And what about your little Rose, your Rose of Tralee, yes. Little Denniston Rose? Yes. Where did she come to you from?
Well, I hadn't been planning to put her in, actually, but I suppose when I look back, when I first started that, I was a little bit worried about one of my grandchildren who was having a bit of a tough time, and yet watching him cope with his tough time, I was amazed at his resilience and his good nature. And I thought, some kids are just blessed with a good nature who can manage a difficult situation. Other kids will go under and turn bad or whatever. And so that kind of, I didn't realise till after that I was writing, I was influenced that way. But
Tell us about her then. Tell us, for people who haven't yet read the book, who is she? What's she like? What does she get up to?
She's a tough little cookie, is my Rose, and she comes up with her mother right back in the early days. The Denniston has been opened as a mine for 2 years when she comes, but it's still a real rough and rowdy place. And her mother is a bit of a mother from hell, you would have to say. And Rose is left on her own, more or less, to cope with life.
And but how old is she when she first comes?
She's just not quite five.
She's a little,
but is quite capable, because her mother's been haymaking, as they call it, which is gold mining in the sand, and she's been up and down, and her mother's been also running a saloon, a bit of a rough one. So her mother's I wouldn't even say a rough diamond, a rough piece of coal maybe. And Rose has learnt to cope, but she's a charmer, she's good looking, and she's blessed with a good nature. So she's got a few quirks to her. She's got a bit light fingered,
which would come with being with a mother like that.
Exactly, exactly. So she's learnt that to survive, she's got to charm other people, and some of these tough old miners are charmed by Rose. But there's a little bit of a dark cloud in her as well, and there's part of the story things turn really bad for her.
And you take that story about her through how many years of her life in this first book?
In this first book, I take it through from 1882 to 80, about 5 years.
So she's about 10 by the time the story finishes.
Maybe 4 years. Yes, okay. Yes, right. More like 9, okay. I think. Mm.
And you are looking, I know that you're working on a sequel to this, so yes. Are you going to keep going with Rose as the central character?
Yes, I'm going to keep Rose in, but I'm going to jump maybe 15 years to when Rose is just in her early 20s or just about 20. So that'll take us to the turn of the century, which is also a little bit different time for Denniston at its height of in the mining times, and where the three towns up there, or two big ones anyway, and it's a different situation. Still the same old bleak, isolated place though.
So tell me more about life for women and children in a coal mining town like Denniston. How hard would it have been?
It would have been unimaginably difficult. When you look at the photographs of the houses that they lived in, tiny houses and sometimes big families in two little rooms, the town that was the mining town was not... There were two towns at this time, Denniston and Burnett's Face, and Burnett's Face was close to the mines. The what was called the Rope Road, which carried the bins of coal out of the mines down to Denniston, was right in front of their houses. Kids would run out and play there, get caught up in the wires and so on, and killed. Mm. It was how they ever got their washing dry. Or even white,
I would imagine.
Not white, yes. I couldn't imagine when you see the tiny little kitchens and you don't actually see in the photographs washing hanging out at all. So I suppose washing was strung out in the kitchen over the coal range, dripping. There was a lot of diphtheria up there. The diseases of the lungs and throat and so on were rife, particularly among children. The death rate was much higher up there.
Were there any doctors that actually settled in a place like that?
Not at the time I'm talking. They came up to visit from Waimangaroa, which was the nearest town down on the coast. They would come up to visit, and there were like weekly rounds. And it wasn't until 1910, a whole lot later, that there was a hospital built there. So if you were mortally wounded or, you know, something that desperately needed help, you had to be bundled into a coal wagon and taken. I mean, it was too late usually. The women had to know their own remedies, and they did. You know, they had rows of bottles and a little bit of this for that and so on.
So that would be, a lot of those remedies would have been things they would have perhaps brought in with them.
Yes.
Yeah, because,
yes.
I mean, was there, one thinks of it being very bleak. I mean, I presume they had to have vegetable gardens and things like that. Did they manage to do those kind of things, herbs?
There was very little soil up there. The plateau itself is quite barren. I think they managed to have grow some things, silver beet, cabbages, but the goods came up in the incline in the same way that people came up. The goods came up, and there were shops up there that sold. The company had a store in those early days. One of the great heartbreaks for the women in particular was that there was not enough soil to bury people.
Oh.
And so
there would have been a lot of miscarriages and stillbirths and things like that.
Yes, yes. And accidents.
Yes.
And so the dead had to go down the incline in an empty coal wagon, and the women who couldn't ride down couldn't bury their dead. They had to see their menfolk go down and bury them right out at Waimangaroa. And so some of them had never seen their children's graves or their sons' graves.
I mean, if I can use the word, it sounds almost like a godforsaken place.
And yet, I mean, I mustn't make it sound so terrible, because there was a wonderful community up there. And there's still a society of people called the Friends of the Hill who used to live up there. It's a ghost town now. Or their ancestors used to live up there. And they talk about the wonderful times. Because they were isolated, they made their own community. They made their own entertainments, and there were heaps of pubs up there. And so I wouldn't like it to sound like it was a bleak and terrible... I mean, the situation outside might have been terrible, but I think they made quite a good and lively life. And there were certainly strong unions, a lot of clubs and meeting houses. There were billiard saloons and so on.
What do you think the population would have got to in its heyday?
In its heyday, it would have. I think there were something like 900 and something in Denniston, and 600 and something in Burnett's Face, and then there was a third town in between, Marshall Vale, a few hundred there. So, you know, I can't...
It's enough to make a community, isn't it, really?
Oh, it certainly was enough to make a community, and they had a secondary school, and they had a school at Burnett's Face, a school at Denniston, and quite a few shops and so on. It definitely was a real community up there.
Well, it really sparks the imagination just listening to you talk today, and I can see it as a TV series. Could you, when you were writing it in your mind, see it on screen?
I could, and I think perhaps partly because I'm a jeweller and I've written stuff for children and so on, I have quite a visual eye, and yes, I could definitely see it as a TV or a movie or something like that. It's such a visual place, and I think it could go very well in that way.
Well, I hope that one day somebody will definitely think of doing it. Meantime, good luck with the sequel.
Thank you.
I hope I'm going to talk to you in about a year's time when the Denniston Rose Part 2 comes out.
I hope so too.
Thank you very much for your time, Jenny.
Thank you, Alice.